Hi. I'm so happy to be here. Can you hear me? Okay. I want to just thank John Maxwell and the actors from New Stage. I was so moved and excited to see you, and you broke the ice. I really appreciate it. And I'm so happy to be honored by the Betty Jolie, with the Betty Jolie Lecture. And I want to thank the Eudora Welty Foundation, Suzanne Mars, who's been carting me around, and the Millsaps College, who I have a doctorate from, but if I'd gone there, I don't even think I could have graduated. Okay. Let me see. So I was born here in Jackson. So I've known about the looming presence of Eudora Welty for about as long as I can remember. Eudora Welty was something no one else was. She was a writer, a famous writer, not just national, my mother told me, international. And she lived in Jackson, my town. William Faulkner lived in Oxford, and he was miles away, and he was a man. Eudora Welty was an anomaly, a famous woman writer who lived in Jackson. And I could gaze at Mrs. Welty in everyday places like Brent's Drugs, Jitney Jungle, Once at a Wedding, New Stage. There they did a play of hers, The Ponder Heart. And because my sister Kayo was in the production and later had her picture taken, sometimes they mistake her for me, and I'm so happy because she's so much younger. Anyway, Eudora Welty would come to the rehearsals, and rehearsals are kind of slow and boring, and people are making mistakes, but she would sit rapt in as the old church turned into a theater, and she'd be in that pew, just focused and laughing out loud with this glee if anything was funny, and so unintimidating to the actors. And I just was thrilled to be that near her. This may not be true, but I clearly remember whenever my mother would often drive with me by Welty's house if we were in the Belhaven area, so we could look up and see if she was writing. And once, at least once, more than once, I think I saw her up there with the curtain, and we spotted her, and we drove on. But then, let's turn around. Got to turn around, but don't let her hear us. So we drove back by to see her again. And I tell you, the image of Eudora Welty working at her desk taught me more about writing than any class I've ever taken. In 1993, I was blessed with the honor of meeting Ms. Welty at her house. A short film based on her iconic story, A Worn Path, was being made, and they had asked Ms. Welty if she would do an interview, and they asked me to interview her. I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but I was thrilled. Now, I was going to meet her, and I was not even intimidated. It was beyond intimidation. Intimidation couldn't even apply to how I felt. I was too lowly to be intimidated. I was meeting Athena. And when I arrived, the scraggly old film crew was there pulling lights and cameras and wires into her house and her yard. And I felt like this was some sort of desecration. But I went on in because the door was opened, and I was kind of told to go back to the breakfast room. And there she was. She was standing there talking with the director. she was apologizing for not being able to have the whole crew for lunch at her house. She, in her very lilting soft voice, and he was saying, oh, it's fine, we're gonna just order in food. And she said, I know, but I've just been ill at the hospital. Otherwise, I would have loved having you, all of you for lunch. And then he left again, and then she turns to me and apologizes for not having them to lunch. I'm so sorry I can't have them for lunch, but I'm just out of the hospital. And I will say, I'm just over bronchitis, so forgive me. And now I'd met her before, you know, but very, hello, she would have no memory of me, and I was so tongue-tied, I'd never really spoken to her. And here she was right before me. Her eyes were just lively, but tired. And she wasn't dressed for a big interview. I think she had on a t-shirt with a sweater over it. And she told me that she had just returned from the hospital where she was getting physical therapy because of her crippling arthritis. And I thought how depressing this was, and I would be so depressed if that was me. But she felt completely to the contrary. She spoke about the various people who were there along with her. There was a young boy about, I think, 6 or 7, who had been thrown onto the highway from a moving car. And he had not spoken since this incident. And he was mute, but Ms. Welty recalled the triumphant day when he spoke and reclaimed his voice in the world. I can't remember exactly how she told the story, but at the end, I felt gold bells ringing through my body and heart. I asked her if she would write about it. To my astonishment, she said she wasn't writing it anymore. She couldn't because of the arthritis in her hand. I came up with the obvious and deeply annoying suggestion that she should get a tape recorder and speak in that. She said that wasn't how she worked. And I had a realization, perhaps it was obvious, but for me it was a realization. Eudora Welty was not an artist because she wrote. She was an artist because she saw, she listened, she remembered, she imagined. The source she wrote from and lived from was love. And there's a passage I read to my students that she wrote that I would like to read to you. It's from Must the Novelist Crusade, an essay. And so finally, I think we need to write with love. Not in self-defense, not in hate, not in the mood of instruction, not in rebuttal, in any kind of militance or in apology, but with love. Not in exorcism either, for this is to make the reader bear a thing for you. Neither do I speak of writing forgivingly. Out of love, you can write with straight fury. It is the source of the understanding that I speak of. It's this that determines the nature and its reach. I just think that's so beautiful because her source was love. She never was making fun of people or judging people or being preachy. She wrote from a source of love. Now, I have a photograph, you might imagine. Well, I have two photographs, black and white, on my court board at my office. And one of them is of Sarah Kane. She's a stunning British playwright who committed suicide in a mental ward at 27. And I love her because while hospitalized and losing her mind, filled with self-loathing, filled with despair, she completed her last play, 448 Psychosis, with the last shred of her shredded heart. The other photo is, of course, Eudora Welty. It's a black and white photo, and I would guess she's in her 70s when it was taken. The photograph shoots her from like here to here, and she's wearing something like a trench coat with her lapels, and she's got a white scarf that seems really bright around her throat. And she seems to be waiting, but looking and watching. Her stance is fascinating, and her eyes are intense. Her left eye is staring with profound comprehension, and the right eye is open with the ache of wonder. She has hair that's like little curls, it's all white, and her forehead is kind of white, and she looks like an angel. Her face is profound, beautiful, and singular, a face that has not only endured, but prevailed. The past January, I was in Jackson speaking at Jackson Prep, and Norma Cox, she's the librarian and event coordinator, gave me a black and white photograph of a young Eudora. She's lithe and young, and she's sitting on the barrel of a Civil War cannon. Dressed in a sleeveless white dress, her feet are resting solidly on the spokes of the wheel, and she has her hair is cut, it's parted here, and it's cut stylishly short, just like, you know, around her ears, and there's a little piece up here, and she's holding a piece of straw in her hand. And she has this kind of composed expression, but alert. She's looking strangely aware that she's on a battlefield. The image of this young Eudora Welty sitting calmly, as though she belongs on the battlefield, says it all. I feel blessed to have these two photographs of Eudora, one when she is beginning to look, to dare to look, and one when she is older, yet her curiosity, empathy, and fearlessness are just deeper and vaster. Now, in response to you, let me think. Am I going on too long? Oh, okay. Because I'm in the theater, and there's nothing like going on too long. But in honor of Eudora's brilliant, iconic book, One Writer's Beginning, I thought I would read from an essay I wrote about me falling in love with the theater here in Jackson. It's shortish. And it's in a book that's called The Plays That Changed My Life, or Plays That Changed My Life. It wasn't a play that initially entranced me with the theater. It was the day my mother arrived to pick up the kindergarten carpool painted green. Astonished, the children and teachers crowded around our station wagon, marveling at the green being behind the wheel. Mama was playing the Green Bean Man in a children's theater production of Jack and the Beanstalk. Maybe she was coming, you know, from dress rehearsal and didn't have time to change. But she made a dashing Green Bean Man. She was thin and sprightly, and I was so amazed how she had eclipsed both species and gender. The magic faded when I saw the play. The beautiful princess was a hunched over, disgruntled, word-swallowing mistake. Why was she playing the fair young damsel? My disappointment was surprisingly catastrophic. I wanted to get lost in the world of giants, magic beans, poor people, and gold. But I could not suspend disbelief long enough to stop believing that the princess should have been cast as the giant, or better yet, a non-speaking peasant. Thus, from an early age, I recognized that casting was crucial. It could make or break a good production and a good actor is hard to find. And thank you, we have found, have some right here. Not long after Beanstalk, I was learning that theater people never said the whole name of a play. That's how you knew they were theater people. I went with my father and my sister to pick up my mother after the matinee of Rain, i.e. a hat full of rain. When we arrived, big men were knocking down the room that was on stage. They frightened me with their big knocking equipment and terrible shouts. The sad-looking room was being torn apart like there was no tomorrow. Walls crashed, sawdust flew, cabins were ruthlessly ripped out. I found my mother in the wings, distraught and weeping. I asked her what was wrong. They're tearing down our home, my kitchen. Why? Because we've closed, Pinky. We've closed. I wondered why they had to get rid of it all so fast. Couldn't they leave it a day or two, a little longer? No, they have to strike so they can load in another show. They'll be here all night. And then she was wiping away tears and going to joke with the loud men who were tearing down her home. I was angry and mixed up. On some level, I learned theater is real, very real, and it ends. A whole world is created that will never stay. How could grown-up people work so hard on something that they knew would disappear in a flash? But I saw these plays were important to my mother in a way real life wasn't. Garden clubs, prizes, grocery shopping, building our patio, or bringing cupcakes to school did not compare to the theater, and it never would. I can't remember if this is the first play I saw my mother in. I'm so nervous, my legs are shaking. Anyway, it was called Mary Mary. And it made a lasting impression on me because I was introduced to the quick change and stage kisses. My mother was playing the lead, Mary, and Mary wore a lot of clothes. Very sophisticated Eastern clothes, perfectly accessorized, exotically wintry, fur, lots of fur, fur-lined boots, fur-lined gloves, sweaters, hats. It was all glamorous and sparkling and very funny when people talked about divorce. That you were supposed to laugh. Behind a flat, there was a small corner where my mother had to take off one entire costume, put on another in a matter of seconds. She had two dressers to help her, and the operation was breathtakingly precise. One flub second, and she would miss her cue. One of the most exciting moments of the show for me was when Mary took her exit for the quick change, and I knew she was rushing like a house on fire to make that change. And she made it, and she was on stage lighting a cigarette, looking cool and calm. The other thing I learned about was the stage kiss. I was intrigued and deeply shocked when my mother was kissed by a handsome, elegant man on a couch. She explained it was not a kiss, it was a stage kiss. I wasn't convinced. Why couldn't they just turn their heads away from the audience and rub cheeks? But the way they were doing it, their lips, I thought, touched. And the audience might mistake it for a real kiss. I told Mama that it didn't bother me, but how about Daddy? Will he be upset? No, of course not. He knows Clive doesn't like women. Oh. Clive was always nice to me, and I knew he and my mother were crazy about each other. But the way she said, Clive doesn't like women, made me know something I didn't know. I stopped worrying that my parents were going to divorce over the stage kiss. Even as people's lips touched, it was all make-believe. There were things you could do in the theater that would not be allowed anywhere else. I became a devotee. The delight I got from theater expressions was profound. It was a secret language, a gypsy jive, cast party, B-U-O-B, understudy, upstaging, phoning it in, Salmon Gel, two-hander, no royalties, goddamn critics, the Scottish play, building costumes, half-hour cue light, callbacks, green room, glow tape, blocking, blackouts, places, ghost light. I would often help my mother memorize her lines. She would lie up in the big four-poster bed and go over her part until she was word perfect. I knew to skip the long speeches of the other characters and go right to her cue. She never became exasperated when I corrected her, only when I didn't. Mama liked to get off book in the first week of rehearsal. She could do this because she was a quick study. That was heartening to me, the memorizing thing. She said, memory is a muscle, Pinky. The more you memorize, the more you remember. And I was memorizing a lot at Dooling Elementary School. Memorize all the state capitals, the state flower, the state birds, memorize all the counties in Mississippi and be able to recite them in alphabetical order. If you omit any county, you will have to start over at the beginning until you do it correctly. Even more miserable with staying after school to work on my cramped handwriting and write words over and over that I misspelled over and over and over again. My big chance to escape civilian life came when the Jackson Little Theater decided to include the prologue in their production of Summer and Smoke. It's a very short scene, but it has a young Miss Alma and a young John. It's a little scene around the fountain. So my mother let me audition. My mother let me audition because I got the part. I could do the scene, go home, get up and go to school, and forego the curtain call except on weekends. She did not want me to fall behind in school or become an obnoxious child actor. Auditions were fraught. Mama warned me I wasn't typecast for the willowy, sickly young Alma. My allergy doctor remarked that I was the only overweight asthmatic he's ever treated. But fate, or the fact that Mama was doing props, I got the part. And I was thrilled. When they measured my costume, I was sucking in my stomach and holding my breath, and costumes were ordered from a New York stock company, costume company. When my old-fashioned girly dress arrived, I was giddy beyond Easter shoes and parasols. Mama felt, and rightly so, Williams instructs in the play that she should be wearing a midi blouse. The costume was too floozy, my mother thought, and a preacher's daughter wouldn't wear such a thing, and she's going to get me a sailor suit. Well, I begged not to wear a sailor suit. I wanted the frilly costume from the New York Stock Company. Mama looked at my desperate face and relented. After all, there were other difficulties. I immediately went on the Metrical diet, where I was allowed 4 cans of chocolate, a liquid, a day, determined to look sickly and ethereal. I drank the undrinkable stuff without complaint. Not focused on my figure, the director was concerned because I was mumbling my words. My breathy voice could not be heard. He exclaimed, "Louder, little Miss Alma. We can't hear you past the footlights. Louder." At home, Mama had me shout my lines while holding a pencil clutched between my teeth. Although my sisters groaned and ridiculed, this extra training helped. Eventually, when I spoke my lines without a pencil in my mouth, there was a marked improvement in my projection as well as my enunciation. I wore a fake braid so young John could pull the ribbon to tease me as he left stage. We would put the fake braid on at home, and boxes of bobby pins were jammed in my scalp, almost like nailing the braid to my skull. But once I got to the theater, all I needed to do was put on my costumes and check my props. Always check your props, Pinky. It's your responsibility. Actors who don't check their own props are amateurs or fools. Dress rehearsal night, my father was staying home with my sisters. When I was leaving for the theater, he wished me well. Have a good show, little buddy, and don't get stage fright. What's stage fright? Mama gave Daddy a look. There's no such thing as stage fright. He made that up. Break leg, my father offered. I will. It was like a dream being in the production with real adult actors. Miss Alma was played by Jane Petty, and she was a vision with her pale skin and clear blue eyes, her steady gaze. She taught me to shut my eyes tightly as soon as I turn up stage at the end of the scene. That way my vision can adjust enough so I can make my way off stage in the blackout. Emulating Jane Petty, I would twist the ring on my finger around and around. How well this gesture revealed Alma's otherworldliness, her sensitivity. I wondered if Jane Petty was my doppelganger. Things went wonderfully until the night Scott Cook, you might know him, young John, pulled my hair ribbon with such force that the fake braid went flying off my head and he was clutching it in his hand. I banged off stage in the blackout. I ran tearfully down a hall to hide my humiliation. Scott got yelled at by grown-ups, and he was sent to me to apologize. He promised he was sorry. I only pulled it hard once to see what would happen. I nodded my head and pretended to be fine. I won't do it again. We stood silently in the dark hall. There was a moment in the scene where young John quickly kisses young Alma on the cheeks. Scott pondered what it would be like to kiss for real on the mouth. I wonder as well. We kissed on the lips in the dark hallway. I ran away, heart pounding, believing my reputation was forever ruined because I had kissed on the lips while only in fifth grade elementary. Kissing seemed to be a theme in the theater. I imagined with rehearsals, I could get used to it. My final and complete rebellion against civilian life came when I learned I was not allowed to see the play that was opening the new stage theater, starring none other than Jane Petty. A small church by the railroad tracks had been converted into a 50-seat theater. It was Jackson's first experimental theater. The town was in an uproar because their premier production was Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Now, I had no idea who Edward Albee was or Virginia Woolf, but I wanted to see something experimental. I asked my mother, what's so bad about Virginia Woolf? It's a play on words. Who's Afraid is the big wolf. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? How people fear knowing the truth. All that we hide, fear and lies. I did not get it. On further study, I learned Virginia Woolf was an English writer who put rocks in her pocket and walked in the river so she could drown. What was so scary about that? Why did you have to be 17 to get into that? My mother did not mind if I saw the play, but she didn't want to rock the boat. The theater was already under fire for being avant-garde. They were opening with a play that used profanity, dealt with sexual subjects, and was written by a homosexual. All this on top of the fact that black people were welcome to buy tickets and be in the audience. Damn, I wanted to see that play. I picked up a copy of Woolf that we had around the house and read it diligently, like I knew what it was about and could not understand why civilians we're so outraged. The play is, after all, art. Absolutely, in my estimation, it was fine art, and these small-minded people and with their objections were stupid, entirely despicable. Really, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Who? Well, I wasn't. The theater wasn't, and neither was my mama, and never was Eudora Welty afraid of Virginia Woolf. Thank you. Thanks.